Chapter 25. Tom's first half. Tom Tulliver's sufferings during the first quarter he was at King's Lorton, under the distinguished care of the Rev. Walter Stelling, were rather severe. At Mr. Jacob's academy, life had not presented itself to him as a difficult problem. There were plenty of fellows to play with, and Tom, being good at all active games, fighting especially, had that precedence among them which appeared to him inseparable from the personality of Tom Tulliver. Mr. Jacobs himself, familiarly known as Old Goggles, from his habit of wearing spectacles, imposed no painful awe, and if it was the property of snuffy old hypocrites like him to write like copperplate, and surround their signatures with arabesques, to spell without forethought, and to spout why name is Norval without bungling, Tom, for his part, was glad he was not in danger of those mean accomplishments. He was not going to be a snuffy schoolmaster, he, but a substantial man, like his father, who used to go hunting when he was younger, and rode a capital black mare, as pretty a bit of horse flesh as ever you saw. Tom had heard what her points were 100 times. He meant to go hunting too, and to be generally respected. When people were grown up, he considered, nobody inquired about their writing and spelling. When he was a man, he should be master of everything, and do just as he liked. It had been very difficult for him to reconcile himself to the idea that his school time was to be prolonged, and that he was not to be brought up to his father's business, which he had always thought extremely pleasant. For it was nothing but riding about, giving orders, and going to market, and he thought that a clergyman would give him a great many scripture lessons, and probably make him learn the gospel and epistle on a Sunday, as well as the collect. But in the absence of specific information, it was impossible for him to imagine that school and a schoolmaster would be something entirely different from the academy of Mr. Jacobs. So, not to be at a deficiency, in case of his finding genial companions, he had taken care to carry with him a small box of percussion caps. Not that there was anything particular to be done with them, but they would serve to impress strange boys with a sense of his familiarity with guns. Thus poor Tom, though he saw very clearly through Maggie's illusions, was not without illusions of his own, which were to be cruelly dissipated by his enlarged experience at King's Lorton. He had not been there a fortnight before it was evident to him that life, complicated not only with the Latin grammar, but with a new standard of English pronunciation, was a very difficult business, made all the more obscure by a thick mist of bashfulness. Tom, as you have observed, was never an exception among boys for ease of address, but the difficulty of enunciating a monosyllable in reply to Mr. or Mrs. Stelling was so great that he even dreaded to be asked at table whether he would have more pudding. As to the percussion caps, he had almost resolved, in the bitterness of his heart, that he would throw them into a neighboring pond. For not only was he a solitary pupil, but he began even to have a certain skepticism about guns, and a general sense that his theory of life was undermined. For Mr. Stelling thought nothing of guns, or horses either, apparently, and yet it was impossible for Tom to despise Mr. Stelling as he had despised Old Goggles. If there were anything that was not thoroughly genuine about Mr. Stelling, it lay quite beyond Tom's power to detect it. It is only by a wide comparison of facts that the wisest full-grown man can distinguish well-rolled barrels from mere supernal thunder. Mr. Stelling was a well-sized, broad-chested man, not yet 30, with flaxen hair standing erect, and large lightish gray eyes, which were always very wide open. He had a sonorous bass voice, and an air of defiant self-confidence inclining to brazenness. He had entered on his career with great vigor, and intended to make a considerable impression on his fellowmen. The Rev. Walter Stelling was not a man who would remain among the inferior clergy all his life. He had a true British determination to push his way in the world, as a schoolmaster, in the first place, Therefore there were capital masterships of grammar schools to be had, and Mr. Stelling meant to have one of them. But as a preacher also, for he meant always to preach in a striking manner, so as to have his congregation swelled by admirers from neighboring parishes, and to produce a great sensation, whenever he took occasional duty for a brother clergyman of minor gifts. The style of preaching he had chosen was the extemporaneous, which was held little short of the miraculous in rural parishes like King's Lorton. Some passages of Massillon and Berdalowe, which he knew by heart, were really very effective when rolled out in Mr. Stelling's deepest tones, but as comparatively feeble appeals of his own were delivered in the same loud and impressive manner, they were often thought quite as striking by his hearers. Mr. Stelling's doctrine was of no particular school. If anything, it had a tinge of evangelicalism, for that was he telling thing just then in the diocese to which King's Lorton belonged. In short, Mr. Stelling was a man who meant to rise in his profession, and to rise by merit, clearly, since he had no interest beyond what might be promised by a problematic relationship to a great lawyer who had not yet become Lord Chancellor. A clergyman who has such vigorous intentions naturally gets a little into debt at starting. It is not to be expected that he will live in the meager style of a man who means to be a poor curate all his life. And if the few hundreds Mr. Timpson advanced toward his daughter's fortune did not suffice for the purchase of handsome furniture, together with a stock of wine, a grand piano, and the laying out of a superior flower garden, it followed in the most rigorous manner, either that these things must be procured by some other means, or else that the Rev. Mr. Stelling must go without them, which last alternative would be an absurd procrastination of the fruits of success, where success was certain. Mr. Stelling was so broad-chested and resolute that he felt equal to anything. He would become celebrated by shaking the consciences of his hearers, and he would by and by edit a Greek play and invent several new readings. He had not yet selected the play, for having been married little more than 2 years, his leisure time had been much occupied with attentions to Mrs. Stelling. But he had told that fine woman what he meant to do someday, and she felt great confidence in her husband, as a man who understood everything of that sort. But the immediate step to future success was to bring on Tom Tulliver during this first half year, for, by a singular coincidence, there had been some negotiation concerning another pupil from the same neighborhood, and it might further a decision in Mr. Stelling's favor if it were understood that young Tulliver, who, Mr. Stelling observed in conjugal privacy, was rather a rough cub, had made prodigious progress in a short time. It was on this ground that he was severe with Tom about his lessons. He was clearly a boy whose powers would never be developed through the medium of the Latin grammar without the application of some sternness. Not that Mr. Stelling was a harsh-tempered or unkind man, quite the contrary. He was jocose with Tom at table, and corrected his provincialisms and his deportment in the most playful manner, but poor Tom was only the more cowed and confused by this double novelty, for he had never been used to jokes at all like Mr. Stelling's, and for the first time in his life he had a painful sense that he was all wrong somehow. When Mr. Stelling said, as the roast beef was being uncovered, "Now, Tulliver, which would you rather decline, roast beef or the Latin for it?" Tom, to whom in his coolest moments a pun would have been a hard nut, was thrown into a state of embarrassed alarm that made everything dim to him except the feeling that he would rather not have anything to do with Latin. "Of course," he answered, "roast beef," whereupon there followed much laughter and some practical joking with the plates, from which Tom gathered that he had in some mysterious way refused beef, and, in fact, made himself appear silly. If he could have seen a fellow pupil undergo these painful operations, and survive them in good spirits, he might sooner have taken them as a matter of course. But there are two expensive forms of education, either of which a parent may procure for his son, by sending him as solitary pupil to a clergyman. One is the enjoyment of the reverend gentleman's undivided neglect. The other is the endurance of the reverend gentleman's undivided attention. It was the latter privilege for which Mr. Tulliver paid a high price in Tom's initiatory months at King's Lorton. That respectable miller and maltster had left Tom behind, and driven homeward in a state of great mental satisfaction. He considered that it was a happy moment for him, when he had thought of asking Riley's advice about a tutor for Tom. Mr. Stelling's eyes were so wide open, and he talked in such an offhand, matter-of-fact way, answering every difficult, slow remark of Mr. Tulliver's with, "I see, my good sir, I see, to be sure, semicolon, you want your son, to be a man who will make his way in the world," that Mr. Tulliver was delighted to find in him a clergyman whose knowledge was so applicable to the everyday affairs of this life. Except Counselor Wild, whom he had heard at the last sessions, Mr. Tulliver thought the Reverend Mr. Stelling was the shrewdest fellow he had ever met with, not unlike Wild, in fact. He had the same way of sticking his thumbs in the armholes of his waistcoat. Mr. Tulliver was not by any means an exception in mistaking brazenness for shrewdness. Most laymen thought Stelling shrewd, and a man of remarkable powers generally. It was chiefly by his clerical brethren that he was considered rather a fool fellow. But he told Mr. Tulliver several stories about wing and incendiarism, and asked his advice about feeding pigs in so thoroughly secular and judicious a manner, with so much polished glibness of tongue, that the miller thought here was the very thing he wanted for Tom. He had no doubt this first-rate man was acquainted with every branch of information, and knew exactly what Tom must learn in order to become a match for the lawyers, which poor Mr. Tulliver himself did not know, and so was necessarily thrown for self-direction on this wide kind of inference. It is hardly fair to laugh at him, for I have known much more highly instructed persons than he make inferences quite as wide, and not at all wiser. As for Mrs. Tulliver, finding that Mrs. Stelling's views, as to the airing of linen, and the frequent recurrence of hunger in a growing boy entirely coincided with her own, moreover, that Mrs. Stelling, though so young a woman, and only anticipating her second confinement, had gone through very nearly the same experience as herself with regard to the behavior and fundamental character of the monthly nurse, she expressed great contentment to her husband when they drove away, at leaving Tom with a woman who, in spite of her youth, seemed quite sensible and motherly, and asked advice as prettily as could be. "They must be very well off, though," said Mrs. Tulliver, "for everything's as nice as can be all over the house, and that watered silk as he had on cost a pretty penny. Sister Pullet has got one like it." "Ah," said Mr. Tulliver, "he's got some income besides the curacy, I reckon. Perhaps her father allows him something. There's Tom will be another 100 to him, and not much trouble either, by his own account. He says teaching comes natural to him." "That's wonderful now," added Mr. Tulliver, turning his head on one side, and giving his horse a meditative tickling on the flank. "Perhaps it was because teaching came naturally to Mr. Stelling, that he set about it with that uniformity of method and independence of circumstances which distinguish the actions of animals understood to be under the immediate teaching of nature. Mr. Broderick's amiable beaver, as that charming naturalist tells us, busied himself as earnestly in constructing a dam, in a room up 3 pair of stairs in London, as if he had been laying his foundation in a stream or lake in Upper Canada. It was in his function to build. The absence of water, or of possible progeny, was an accident for which he was not accountable. With the same unerring instinct, Mr. Stelling set to work at his natural method of instilling the Eton grammar and Euclid into the mind of Tom Tulliver. This, he considered, was the only basis of solid instruction. All other means of education were mere charlatanism, and could produce nothing better than smatterers. Fixed on this firm basis, a man might observe the display of various or special knowledge made by irregularly educated people with a pitying smile, All that sort of thing was very well, but it was impossible these people could form sound opinions. In holding this conviction, Mr. Stelling was not biased, as some tutors have been, by the excessive accuracy or extent of his own scholarship. And as to his views about Euclid, no opinion could have been freer from personal partiality. Mr. Stelling was very far from being led astray by enthusiasm, either religious or intellectual. On the other hand, he had no secret belief that everything was humbug. He thought religion was a very excellent thing, and Aristotle a great authority, and deaneries and prebends useful institutions, and Great Britain the providential bulwark of Protestantism, and faith in the unseen a great support to afflicted minds. He believed in all these things, as a Swiss hotel keeper believes in the beauty of the scenery around him, and in the pleasure it gives to artistic visitors. And in the same way Mr. Stelling believed in his method of education. He had no doubt that he was doing the very best thing for Mr. Tulliver's boy. Of course, when the miller talked of apping and dumbing in a vague and diffident manner, Mr. Stelling had set his mind at rest by an assurance that he understood what was wanted. For how was it possible the good man could form any reasonable judgment about the matter? Mr. Stelling's duty was to teach the lad in the only right way, indeed he knew no other. He had not wasted his time in the acquirement of anything abnormal. He very soon set down poor Tom as a thoroughly stupid lad, for though by hard labor he could get particular declensions into his brain, anything so abstract as the relation between cases and terminations could by no means get such a lodgment there as to enable him to recognize a chance genitive or dative. This struck Mr. Stelling as something more than natural stupidity. He suspected obstinacy, or at any rate indifference, and lectured Tom severely on his want of thorough application. "Why you feel no interest in what you're doing, sir," Mr. Stelling would say, and the reproach was painfully true. Tom had never found any difficulty in discerning a pointer from a setter, when once he had been told the distinction, and his perceptive powers were not at all deficient. I fancy they were quite as strong as those of the Rev. Mr. Stelling. For Tom could predict with accuracy what number of horses were cantering behind him, he could throw a stone right into the center of a given ripple, he could guess to a fraction how many lengths of his stick it would take to reach across the playground, and could draw almost perfect squares on his slate without any measurement. But Mr. Stelling took no note of these things. He only observed that Tom's faculties failed him before the abstractions hideously symbolized to him in the pages of the Eton Grammar, and that he was in a state bordering on idiocy with regard to the demonstration that two given triangles must be equal, though he could discern with great promptitude and certainty the fact that they were equal. Whence Mr. Stelling concluded that Tom's brain, being peculiarly impervious to etymology and demonstrations, was peculiarly in need of being plowed and harrowed by these patent implements. It was his favorite metaphor that the classics and geometry constituted that culture of the mind which prepared it for the reception of any subsequent crop. I say nothing against Mr. Stelling's theory. If we are to have one regimen for all minds, it seems to me as good as any other. I only know it turned out as uncomfortably for Tom Tulliver as if he had been plied with cheese in order to remedy a gastric weakness which prevented him from digesting it. It is astonishing what a different result one gets by changing the metaphor. Once call the brain an intellectual stomach, and one's ingenious conception of the classics and geometry as plows and harrows seems to settle nothing. But then it is open to someone else to follow great authorities, and call the mind a sheet of white paper or a mirror, in which case one's knowledge of the digestive process becomes quite irrelevant. It was doubtless an ingenious idea to call the camel the ship of the desert, but it would hardly lead one far in training that useful beast. O Aristotle, if you had had the advantage of being the freshest modern instead of the greatest ancient, would you not have mingled your praise of metaphorical speech, as a sign of high intelligence, with the lamentation that intelligence so rarely shows itself in speech without metaphor, that we can so seldom declare what a thing is, except by saying it is something else? Tom Tulliver, being abundant in no form of speech, did not use any metaphor to declare his views as to the nature of Latin. He never called it an instrument of torture, and it was not until he had got on some way in the next half year, and in the Delectus, that he was advanced enough to call it aor and easily stuff. At present, in relation to this demand that he should learn Latin declensions and conjugations, Tom was in a state of as blank unimaginativeness concerning the cause and tendency of his sufferings, as if he had been an innocent shrew mouse imprisoned in the split trunk of an ash tree in order to cure lameness in cattle. It is doubtless almost incredible to instructed minds of the present day that a boy of 12, not belonging strictly to the masses, who are now understood to have the monopoly of mental darkness, should have had no distinct idea how there came to be such a thing as Latin on this earth. Yet so it was with Tom. It would have taken a long while to make conceivable to him that there ever existed a people who bought and sold sheep and oxen, and transacted the everyday affairs of life, through the medium of this language, and still longer to make him understand why he should be called upon to learn it, when its connection with those affairs had become entirely latent. So far as Tom had gained any acquaintance with Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.